Good morning. At Texas A&M, when you we were told a long time ago, when you're trying to get the room to quiet down, you just say howdy. And they all say howdy back, and that's all it takes. Howdy.
Howdy.
That kind of works. Probably have to say something about Florida State to get John's attention. That doesn't even work. This morning, we're going to work in our transition from, although I've been calling all of the rest of Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah, there are those who call what we're about to do 3rd Isaiah. And again, I don't have the expertise to make anything more than an opinion about that, not a judgment for sure. I did see something that I thought was amusing a few weeks ago that I'd forgotten about, but someone had written an article called A Source Critic Looks at Downton Abbey, and just determined based on, based on the content that there were three redactors of Downton Abbey, and I'll have to make that available for y'all to look at. It's humorous. But sometimes the analysis of Isaiah gets, even to my eye, and again, far from an expert, but they look at things and they say, well, these two verses were clearly written by someone else in this bigger context where all this stuff was written by someone else. I don't know how you actually figure that out with just a verse or two or a word or two. Maybe it's possible, but it really just seems too finely grained sometimes. But I see the bigger picture where there are clear differences between 1 through 39 and 40 through 66, and even the subject matter from 40 through 55 and 55 through 66 changes. So I think they have a point about some of those things. Among all those other things we talked about as we started class many weeks ago. Yes, sir.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good, but including people who were grading them, unfortunately. So this morning, as we transition into, you know, 3rd Isaiah, I decided not to do the actual introduction of that, to hold off, because next week we're doing the play, and the week after that I won't be here. I'll be in Arkansas. We're in the Christmas season, so if we separate the introduction from the content too much, you know, it just doesn't seem the height of wisdom to do that. So I thought we would zoom out and look back this week. And look at Isaiah 1 through 55, just from pulling together one of the threads that runs through the whole thing that I have seen as I've gone through it. There are more threads than I can pull on, but if we're taking, you know, where we started and saying 2 Timothy 3:16, all scriptures inspired, etc., useful for us, applies to us, and looking at Isaiah, what we've done is we've kind of gone into a medium focus. We've looked at it chapter by chapter, section by section, not necessarily word by word. But in extending that over, this is week 16 of when I've been teaching, and Lance taught 1 through 39 for the weeks before that. It's been all this year that we've spent on Isaiah. You can lose sight of where we started and miss the connecting tissue that pulls everything together. So if we're using 2 Timothy 3:16 and remembering that we can't look back on them in arrogance. Our issues are their issues. Their issues are our issues. This is God's story of his interaction with his people. Therefore, it's instructive for us because he's still interacting with his people in the same ways. And the things that we struggle with are the things they struggle with. So, zooming out, I wanted to take where we ended last week, this concept of shalom, and read ourselves into this story of Isaiah, starting at the beginning and moving forward. So just first as a reminder, and again, others can help with this because I definitely do not have my arms fully around this. But just let's remember what shalom is. It's this deep, deep peace. So it translates as peace, but it's much more than that. It's fundamental peace. Peace in everything. It's deep down okayness. It's things being as they should be. So if we're in shalom, then all those things that we're craving, all those deepest needs that we seek, they're met. Okay? So, you know, the things that we grasp at, we're looking for security and significance and love and attention, all those things. Well, if we're experiencing shalom, then those needs are being met. We have peace with ourselves. We have peace with God. We have peace with those that we love around us. It is that deep, deep, deep okayness, rightness. Now, do others want to add to that or subtract from that?
So many of the songs complain. Mm-hmm. You know, I am not peaceful about this. But then they end, but I know who's God. And I think the point is this isn't some, you know, ethereal, you know, Buddhist sort of disattachment. It's a leaning in. Mm-hmm. That God, I know you got this. It's the change as we talked about on Tuesday morning in the men's study on Genesis. It's the name change of Jacob from I'm the last line of defense, you know, rear guard is one of the translations of that name to God's got this. Mm-hmm. God's struggling. God is fighting, and it's that context. It's not that I beat myself up because I'm troubled about something. That I'm allowing myself to be troubled about something. It's that I'm troubled about it, and I'm saying, but I know you got it.
Yeah, that's good, and we'll talk about that more today. Other comments about that shalomness, something that I'm missing, or if I'm putting too much into it, others can weigh in the absence of someone leaping forward there. I'm going to keep going. So chapters 1 through 39, taking this thread of shalom, and putting ourselves into it. In 1 through 39, we looked for okayness. We looked for wholeness. We looked for peace among the nations. Okay? So we turn to alliances. We turn to power and politics. We turn to popularity, legal systems, to find shalom. We adopt the world standard of success. We adopt the world's ways of judging, the world's ways of seeing, in looking for shalom. That's our struggle in chapters 1 through 39. We're looking to our neighbors, to those around us. Instead of being salt and light, instead of being the servant to show the better way, we adopt the ways of those around us. And God is saying in those chapters, in every way he can, this is not going to end up the way you want it to. This is not going to give you the peace that you're seeking. It's not going to work. It's going to go the exact opposite direction of what you're trying to do. This will not give you those deep things you're seeking for. So he says, look at the seen versus the unseen. This is one of those big themes from Isaiah, seen versus unseen. Look at this army. Put faith in me and see what happens. And in that brief instant, we do. And they all get sick and go home. And then we just turn right back. Well, God, what would you have us do instead? Be the servant. Be my servant. But we don't listen, and maybe it's because of fear. And so God, in 1 through 39, starts dropping all these breadcrumbs. He's putting all these markers down, these signs, so that when we look back, we'll see that he was telling us this. So we have these songs of all these nations in 1 through 39. So there's a song of Edom, a song of Assyria. And you can almost get the sense that this is done so that, like when we read chapter 53 and see Jesus so clearly in that suffering servant song, well, when Edom falls, Israel can look back and say, remember that crazy song Isaiah made us learn about Edom? It just happened. God's dropping all these markers about the nations. Here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen. Those that you think are most powerful, here's what that's going to look like. So that when it does happen, we can look back and see he was right all along. He's giving us, in his grace and love, all these signs and markers and breadcrumb trail back to him. So that when we finally look in the direction we should look in, we see more clearly what he's doing. So that trail leads us back to servanthood. Then we get in chapters 40 through 48, and we realize that our pursuit of shalom didn't end up where we hoped it would. We are at the bottom of the heap in these chapters. We're in exile. We've lost everything that we held dear. We're in a world where we wonder if God is even relevant anymore. Now, when we looked at these chapters, we saw that the Israelites were asking questions like, can he save and will he save? Well, if I rephrase those for us, I would say, does he have any power here in this situation? And if he does he care? Because that's how we would phrase it. That's how we would experience it. That's where our doubts would come in similar language to their doubts. Because if he's relevant to this situation, why isn't he doing anything about it? So we have these questions about God in 40 through 48. So in trying to find peace and trying to seek out shalom in 40 through 48, we start to look around from the bottom of the heap to see, well, what seems to be working for everybody else? How do they seem to be okay? So again, instead of being salt and light, which, how do you be salt and light when you're at the bottom of the heap? Instead of being salt and light, we look around and see, well, what works? What seems to work? And we notice, as we look around us, that those that seem to be successful and happy and at peace in all the commercials and all the stories and all the smiling faces around us, there's this rule of cause and effect at play. If I do this, then this happens. We see the commercial, it's only weird if it doesn't work. Yeah. So we start making solutions to give us shalom with our own hands. We take charge of our own peace. by building solutions ourselves. We even approach our relationship with God with this cause and effect idea. We've talked about this, where if I do this, then God will do that. If God has not done this, then I did not do something I was supposed to. So I pray to God with this agenda without listening. I do disciplines with an agenda without listening. And my intent is to get God to do something in response to what I'm doing. Cause and effect. Seems to work. So our approach to God is cause and effect. Our approach to peace is cause and effect. If I get my 401k funded, I'm going to be fine. If I have this kind of relationship, I'm going to be fine. If my bank account looks like this, if these things, this cause will give me this effect, peace. Because it seems to work for everyone around us. This is what's happening in 40 through 48. Everyone around us seems to have the answer again. So let's get this cause and effect figured out and nailed down. God says in 40 through 48, you've got cause and effect all wrong. When in my history of working with you has it ever worked that way? In Egypt, you didn't do anything. I rescued you. Then you respond. You didn't deserve it then. You've never deserved it. I act in love. You respond. Not you act, I respond. The causes and effects you think you see in those around you don't really work, God says. There's a great reversal coming for those at the top of the heat right now. We have that chapter 47, I think, where it's the daughter of Babylon who's at the top of the heap right now, and God says, it's just going to be like a blink of an eye and you're going to be at the bottom. All those things that look like they work, that give people success, are temporary. All those things that you build with your own hands to give you peace fail at some point. They won't give you peace. It doesn't work like you think it works. Cause and effect is backwards. So the real cause and effect, again, is that I, God, act and you respond to that action. So you can trust the solution you make for yourself, God says, or you can trust the solution from the one who made you. That's your choice. He says, often in the prophets, your prayers are detestable to me because you're trying to make your own solution and it won't give you shalom. Your sacrifices are to manipulate me, not to change you. You can't do anything to deserve my rescue, but I'm going to do it anyway, God says. And then when you pray, it will change you, because that's what prayer and sacrifice are designed to do. Change to what? To being my servant. So servanthood, 40 through 48, again. So, we get in chapters 49 through 52. And we see God talking about his servant. God, it's really hard to be your servant. It's really, really, really hard. People don't get what we're doing. People don't get this servant that you're talking about. They're mistreating him. He's not at the top of the heap. It doesn't look like there's any way what you're telling us to do will give us peace. It does not make sense. In 49 through 52, we get really discouraged. Because something along the way detaches us from understanding God's plan, and we feel alone and abandoned, and we're sitting there, the servant and Israel, discouraged, abandoned, feeling like failures, feeling like, has my pursuit of God been stupid of me? Is this a failed strategy? God, we get disappointed with you because you seem to let us down. It seems like we start following you and then you disappear. God responds in 49 through 52 and says, remember the seen versus the unseen. Keep going. If you're on that place where your vision is limited and you can't see what I'm doing, keep going. Keep going in the direction you last saw me going in. Stay true to what you can't see, but what you know that I'm doing. You'll come through this and you'll see clearly again. Keep moving. Don't give up. Act in faith. And then he says, I'll show you by example what it means to be the servant. So we get to 52 and 53, and we have our big finale to the four servant songs, and really probably the peak climax of the book of Isaiah, with the suffering servant. And we look at this, and we see this is amazing and impossibly hard at the same time. It's amazing because we see that someone following God, this servant, would be willing to do this for all of us. There's someone who will do this, die for all of us. It's amazing. But then, God, if that's what you expect of me too, I don't know that I can do that. If that's what it means to be your servant, I don't know. That is impossibly hard. It seems like foolishness and a stumbling block. We see the servant die. But then we see that death somehow is not the end in 53. And maybe we start to make a connection that death is the worst possible thing that can happen in the realm of the seen. But in the unseen, it's just a transformation. Because somehow, there is peace for that servant at the end of 53. Somehow there is shalom after the servant sacrifices his life. And then we get to 54 and 55. And God says to us, you were never alone. In this whole journey from the beginning, you have never been alone, never abandoned. There were many times when you couldn't see me because you weren't focused on the unseen. But I never left you alone. How could I leave you alone? We were blind to the larger unseen reality. God says, are you starting to see that the things that you crave for shalom, bread and milk, food that feeds the body, is not what gives you peace, but what I give you that's unseen, that you can't buy, is what gives you peace. Can you not start to see that? God says. He says, my ways are not your ways. There is unseen bigness to this that you can tap into that you haven't. But see this, So, without going into what comes next, looking back, what does it mean for us to be the servant? Somehow, that's something that we can do regardless of our station in life. Because it's what God expected of us when we were the top of the heap. And it's what He expected of us when we were at the bottom of the heap. We can assume it's what He expects when we're in the middle of the heap too. In the New Testament, we have these connections to this. Unseen and seen. Unseen, in the kingdom of God, there's no difference between slave and free. None. And yet in the seen in the New Testament, Onesimus goes back to Philemon. So the slave's position in that household somehow isn't as real as the equality of the two. In the unseen, those two are equal. In the seen, they're not. One of those is real and one of them's not. Somehow, Onesimus is supposed to be equal to Philemon while being a slave to Philemon. He's at the bottom of the heap. Somehow. Many in the New Testament went to their deaths, Stephen being one of those, which is the end of the scene. But even in his account, or the account of his death, he's talking about seeing the unseen, the bigger reality. Somehow, he had shalom. In the worst possible outcome of the scene, painful death by stoning, he had shalom. We have all through this imagery, and N.T. Wright really is a great source for this kind of stuff, of the kingdom of God, already and not yet. We talk about that often. But there is an already part. You know, we often think about the coming kingdom when Jesus is in charge and everything will be okay. Well, He's in charge now. It's the unseen, bigger kingdom that we're supposed to be part of. The seen is not real, but it appears real. In the unseen, in Isaiah, your God reigns. Jesus is on the throne now. He ascended to the throne to rule. Somehow the unseen is more real than the seen. So what kind of servanthood is this He's looking for from us? Well, we have to remember that it's a royal servant. It's not a house servant. It's a royal servant, meaning in the New Testament, the ambassador. This is the representative of the king to a distant people, an ambassador. To a people that are, a different country. So, this servanthood what is expected is that the reality that we live in, the unseen reality that's bigger than the seen, in that reality, we are the personal representative of the most powerful being anywhere. So if I think I'm working in the seen, I'm a slave. If I'm working in the unseen, then I have access to inexhaustible resources from the most powerful kingdom that's ever existed or ever will to do the mission that I was sent to do. And regardless of what happens externally, three-dimensionally, that I can see, there's a reality that's bigger than that. So, a God is saying to us in Isaiah, choose the reality you're going to live in. You can live in the reality of being a slave, what you can see, where you're grasping at things that you think will make you happy, where your life is spent pursuing things as desperately as you can that you hope will give you shalom. Or you can choose the reality of the servant, the bigger reality of the unseen. And often, the reality of servanthood, God has to work on us to pry things out of our fingers that distract us from shalom. As a slave, we're grasping as tightly as we can. We seek them. As a servant, we're letting them go because they don't give us peace. That's not where shalom comes from. So what are we supposed to do as servants? The mission is the same from the beginning to the end. Shalom to the world. Salt and light. Blessing to the nations. Choosing God isn't about giving stuff up. It's about getting everything that you've been craving deep down. The only stuff you have to give up is the stuff that keeps you from getting it. It's not having to worry about all the crap we've been grasping at before. Because death is not the end. And that's really, really, really good news. So our message, our role as servants, is not telling the world this sad sack view of what it means to be a follower of God. Now think of all the fun stuff you have to give up to be a Christian. That's not what it is at all. Think about all the stupid stuff you can leave behind and be at peace. It's right there waiting. It's for us. It's just choosing. So, this is one thread that I see in Isaiah. There are other threads we could take as well. A thread of the activity of God in his rescue. But since we ended last week talking about shalom, it seemed appropriate to look at that thread in Isaiah. So we have about 10 minutes left. See if y'all have any comments or what you want to talk about or challenge. Go ahead, John.
You know, if the marriage is not everything it ought to be, if the children are not everything, if the finances are not everything, if the house is not everything, if the politics are not, then all of a sudden we begin to kind of say, well, you know, there are some byproducts for this, sure.
Mm.
And I think that what you're saying this morning is there's no guaranteed byproducts.
Yeah.
And I think that's what God says. But we live in this culture that in the very atmosphere we breathe, says that if there's a Horatio Alger aspect to all of this, that says if you do the right thing, wonderful things will come your way.
Yeah, in the scene.
In the scene.
Yep. We
and
do.
So it's hard not to get them muddled up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that helps us see with clarity a little bit better how we should look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shannon? Yeah. Yeah, I wish I had a beautiful answer to that. I don't. I would say, just like in Isaiah, some of that in the history of Israel is God saying, if you're being the servant, you will be okay. If you get distracted by these other things and start grasping at the wrong things, it's not going to lead where you want. I think that's really more what is being said there. You want to comment there?
Well, yeah, I think obviously only one has walked in the Lord's way perfectly. So there's, and he was opposed. The world system will always oppose that. And because we are corrupt at a fundamental level, that until and unless we are fully submitting, which to the Spirit's leading, as those who've been given an enabling by God to walk in His way more closely. The fact is that we corrupt it, and so it can never be the if then. It is never there's always going to be a corrupting element that, whether it's opposition by the world system, does not acknowledge and honor God, whether it is pieces of our heart that we haven't given over. You know, we can't look at things and say, I did all this and you didn't do that. Mm-hmm. That's one of the messages that he's saying. That to me, it seems in these Isaiah passages, he's saying, I'm disciplining you to know this, mm-hmm. to understand that you did not walk in my statutes, to understand that you decided you were going to alloy this pure gold that I've given you, and you were going to alloy it with tin, and with the, you know, the corrupt elements of the world, and you expected good to come of mm-hmm. it, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I love you enough to show you. I love you enough to discipline you. I love you enough to break that down. And to me, that's what 1 John 1 is talking about. That God is showing us by His life where we are corrupt. We're seeing that shadow of where we are not walking directly to Him, and He is causing us to recognize first that there is no, you know, deservedness in any of this. There's mm-hmm. no if then. You didn't
yep.
do it all,
yep.
so you don't deserve it all. And also He's bringing us back to what? To repentance, to confession, to an acknowledgement of who He is.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's clear, to as clear as it can be to me, and take that with a grain of salt, is that you have language in the Bible and in Isaiah specifically and in the Psalms specifically where God is saying, I have loved you all through this. Discipline that I'm giving you is out of love to show you where you get peace and where you don't get peace. Now, sometimes in Scripture, the expression is from the one doing the following, and it seems like, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know, so the discipline isn't fun, but the purpose of the discipline is peace. It was to get us to let go of those things. Brian, you were raising your hand.
Walk in His life, and we don't see those blessings when someone else is getting it. And I think perspective you have to have is you have to look at everything through the perspective of the scene. And that not only does that allow you to not fall off the cliff when blessing doesn't come, even in the midst of faithfulness, but also to not wander from faithfulness when blessings do come. And to keep that in perspective. And along those lines, I think the challenge, I mean, whether you're rich or poor, in exile or in the seat of power, there's always that the challenge of seeing things through God's perspective is always there. And it might be the specific challenge might be different, but you know, whereas I might say, oh, it's easier for poor people to have faith in God because they don't have money. Well, it's there's another struggle for them that rich people don't have. Mm-hmm. And so there's always that challenge. I think that's it all goes back to filling that hole God, instead of whatever else is out there, whatever that immediate temptation is that Satan continually tries to point us to.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate you bringing that perspective and bringing it out after that really connects to me on seeing unseen and here's what audience and Isaiah see and here's how it was lined up.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I played in front of 10,000 people, I was up there playing guitar.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sounds like it's time to end. So thank you.